September 20th, 1994, Oak Grove, Kentucky. 22-year-old Candy Belt and 18-year-old Gloria Ross are found shot to death with their throats slashed at the massage parlor where they were working. It turns out the business was a front for a brothel, and suspicion is directed toward a local police officer named Ed Carter, who is alleged to have been involved in a dispute with the owner. 19 years later, Carter and two suspects are charged for their roles in the murders, but since the DNA evidence does not match any of them, they are all acquitted at trial and no one ever faces justice for the crime. After that, the trail went cold.
Hello everyone, and welcome to our latest episode of The Trail Went Cold. I'm your host Robin Warder, and today we're going to be covering a brutal double homicide, the 1994 murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross. That voice you just heard narrating our intro was Samantha Hope Cannon, the latest winner of our most recent Trail Went Cold listener voiceover contest, so thank you very much, Samantha. This has been a recurring monthly contest which we've been holding for nearly 4 years now, and if you'd like to enter and haven't already done so, I will be providing instructions near the end of this episode. Anyway, this case received nationwide attention when it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries, and it is sometimes referred to as the Kentucky Bordello Murders. It's a sensational story involving corruption and scandal in a small town, and the crime in question took place at a massage parlor that doubled as a brothel, and the two female victims were sex workers. It's been alleged that the operation was allowed to function because the local police department was paid off and invited to partake in the bordello services, but one officer, Ed Carter, supposedly caused so much friction about wanting to be involved with the business that he became the most likely suspect after the murders took place. 2 decades later, Carter and two other suspects would be charged for their roles in the crime and go on trial, but the case against them turned out to be very problematic, and since no physical evidence linked them to the murder scene, they were all found not guilty. I have to admit that there have been so many twists and turns in this story that I'm not entirely sure what to believe anymore, but at this moment, the investigation is right back to square one. So on this episode, we're going to explore whether Ed Carter and his alleged co-conspirators got away with murder, or if the real perpetrator has managed to elude justice. However, before we get started, just a quick reminder that The Trail Went Cold is a weekly podcast, which is currently available for download on several platforms, including Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, and Spotify. So if you like this podcast, be sure to subscribe to it, and please leave us a rating or review on any of those sites to help spread the word and garner us more exposure. The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so if you would like to learn how to support the show, please visit our page at patreon.com/thetrailwentcold. For as little as $1 a month, you can garner access to exclusive rewards, which may include stickers and thank you cards, early access to episodes, and bonus content. So with all that out of the way, let us now explore the murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross. Our story begins in 1994 in Oak Grove, Kentucky, a small town located in Christian County next to the Tennessee state line. At this point, Oak Grove has a population of just over 3,000 people and is adjacent to the Army base Fort Campbell. Our two victims are 18-year-old Glory Ann Ross and 22-year-old Candida Darlene Belt, who goes by the name Candy. Glory is currently married to Ryan Ross, a soldier who has recently been transferred to Fort Campbell, and the couple have two children, the youngest of whom is only 6 weeks old. Candy has two children of her own, but is raising them as a single mother after their father deserted them. Both women work at New Life Fitness and Massage, a massage parlor which shares a building with a Chinese restaurant next to Interstate 24. It's pretty much an open secret in the town that New Life is actually a front for a brothel which employs numerous women as sex workers, including Candy and Gloria. It has been in operation for 2 years and is owned by 28-year-old Tammy Papler and her husband, Ronnie Papler. Tammy had previously been a sex worker in Nashville before moving to the area, and she now functions as a madam for her female employees, as Tammy and Ronnie pocket half the money they bring in. New Life offers various sexual services to a number of different clients, with a good chunk of their business originating from Fort Campbell, which is located a very short distance away. Even though the base had officially declared New Life to be off-limits, the soldiers were still frequent customers. The massage parlor was open 20 hours per day, from 9 a.m. until 5 a.m., and during the early morning hours of September the 20th, five female employees, including Candy and Gloria, were there working the graveyard shift. Since business was very slow and there weren't many customers, two of the women, Tammy Sneed and Millie Burns, decided to leave at around 3 a.m. in order to drive a third employee home, so Candy and Gloria would be alone at the establishment. After dropping off their colleague, Sneed and Burns decided to stop for food and return to the massage parlor at around 3:35. They had trouble opening the front door because a heavy rock which was often used as a doorstop had been used to block the door shut. When the two women finally got the door open, they noticed that Candy and Gloria were not in the reception area, but an ashtray was knocked over and the phone had been taken off the hook. Sneed and Burns then decided to check all of the back rooms, but were soon horrified to discover the nude bodies of Candy and Gloria. They had both been shot in the heads execution style, and their throats were slashed. While Candy's body was on the floor underneath a blanket, Gloria was lying dead on a massage table. Sneed and Burns immediately ran to one of the gates at Fort Campbell for help, where military officials contacted the Oak Grove Police Department. When the police and paramedics arrived at the scene, Gloria was pronounced dead. Candy was still alive and would be airlifted to a hospital in Nashville, but she died a few hours later. An autopsy would reveal the presence of semen in Cindy's vagina and anal cavity, which likely meant she had been raped before she was killed. Since cash had been left behind at the massage parlor, it did not appear that robbery was the motive for the crime. The Oak Grove Police Department employed only one detective named Leslie Duncan, who was summoned to the scene, but he became pretty overwhelmed and decided to ask the Christian County Sheriff's Office for assistance. But when the Sheriff's Office arrived, they were shocked to see that the police had already allowed between 20 to 30 people to enter the building and trample through the crime scene, which may have compromised potential evidence. Well, right from the outset, Tammy Papler had a suspect in mind for the murders. It would later emerge that Tammy had made an arrangement with the Oak Grove PD to let New Life stay in operation and offer them protection in exchange for money and services. The previous Christmas, Tammy had paid the police chief, Milton Perry, $1,200, which he would use to purchase new items for the department, including uniforms, shoes, and police car lights. However, Perry would later admit that he spent a large chunk of the money on a lavish Christmas dinner for his officers and their families. If anyone from law enforcement was planning a raid at New Life, Tammy paid off an emergency dispatcher to warn her they were coming by uttering such phrases as, "A storm is coming," or "Time to get the umbrellas out," over the radio. At one point, police showed up at the massage parlor for a raid, but did not find anything but a half dozen female employees sitting around drinking milk. Of course, most of the Oak Grove police officers took advantage of Tammy's arrangement by becoming regular clients at New Life. The standard procedure for each customer was to sign their initials and provide their driver's license numbers in Tammy's logbooks, and they would also have to sign a form which stated that they were not paying for sex. These police officers were among a select group of customers who were considered to be VIPs and did not have to provide payment, but Tammy would still record their names in the client register so she could pay her employees out of her own pocket for servicing these people. The one Oak Grove policeman who took the most advantage of New Life services was a 24-year-old patrolman and canine officer named Ed Carter. Carter was considered to be a regular client at the massage parlor, and at one point, he had Tammy drop a contract with him for, quote-unquote, janitorial services. On the official record, Carter was working as a part-time janitor for New Life in order to supplement his income, and he was paid a total of $4,800 in checks for cleaning services. But Tammy alleged that this was just a cover because Carter demanded she put him on her payroll and give him hush money for his protection. Everyone who worked there feared that Carter would use his position as a police officer to shut down New Life and arrest them if they did not comply with his demands. On Labor Day weekend, 2 weeks before the murders took place, Tammy and her husband Ronnie decided to go on vacation to New York City. When Tammy returned to the massage parlor, she found Carter sitting at the front desk handling the money as he had decided to take control of the operation while she was gone. Tammy became so furious that she ordered Carter to leave and cut him off the payroll, and she subsequently held a meeting in which she told her employees that Carter was banned from the establishment and not to let him back in. But Carter still had his own key to the building, and he never returned it, and as far as anyone knew, he still had it in his possession when the murders took place. Well, Tammy Sneed and Millie Burns claimed that Carter did briefly stop by the massage parlor at around 2 a.m., on the morning of September the 20th. He attempted to use the phone in the reception area, but oddly, he typed in a few numbers without actually making a call, and he did not say anything before he left. When questioned by police, Carter admitted to having been at the massage parlor, but claimed that he returned home and joined his wife in bed at around 3 a.m., the approximate time period in which the murders were believed to have occurred. Carter also denied Tammy Papler's accusations that he was a customer at New Life and maintained that he only ever performed janitorial work for them. However, only 6 days after the crime took place, Carter's wife Carol filed a domestic violence complaint against him. They would eventually get divorced, and she would contradict his original story. Carol said that she had a habit of checking the clock whenever her husband arrived home, and she was certain that he did not return and climb into bed until a few minutes past 4 a.m. on the morning of September the 20th. She even remembered saying to him, quote, "The only thing open at this time of night are legs." In fact, it was only a few minutes after he climbed into bed when she heard the phone ringing because the department was calling her husband about the murders. Carter arrived at the scene about an hour later, but the other officers noticed that he never even bothered to go inside the building. Carter later revised his story and claimed that after he left the massage parlor at 2 a.m., he went on to have a secret tryst with a female soldier stationed at Fort Campbell. It was believed that the murder weapon was a small .22 caliber handgun, and when questioned, Carter denied owning such a weapon. But his wife Carol disputed this, alleging that he had once bought her a .22 caliber handgun for protection, which he kept hidden under the mattress at home. Carol was certain that the gun was not there on the night of the murders, and she never saw it again. Carter agreed to take a polygraph exam, which he wound up failing, so he retained the services of an attorney. When the local newspapers reported on Carter's janitorial work at New Life, the mayor of Oak Grove publicly stated that Carter had embarrassed the community by agreeing to work at a brothel. The police department pressured Carter to resign, which he agreed to do, and he subsequently moved out of the area and eventually found work as an airport security guard in Louisville. There was also controversy surrounding Leslie Duncan, the Oak Grove police detective who had been assigned the investigation and faced heavy criticism for failing to secure the murder scene. Duncan was also rumored to be a frequent customer at New Life, and he was Ed Carter's former roommate. His investigation went nowhere, and the following year, Duncan voluntarily resigned from the police force at the urging of the mayor and went to work as a security guard at a discount store in Nashville. In November of 1994, the authorities would finally shut down New Life Fitness and Massage for good, and Tammy and Ronnie Papler were charged with promoting prostitution. They both agreed to plead guilty to a third-degree misdemeanor charge and received 2 years probation. Tammy decided to focus her energy on running her second business, an adult video store called Cherry Video, but in an attempt to clean up the town's image, the mayor of Oak Grove decided to raise the annual license fee for sexually oriented businesses from $50 to $5,000 per year. This enraged Tammy enough that she decided to appear at an Oak Grove City Council meeting, which took place on July the 15th, 1997. For the first time ever, Tammy publicly spoke out about the vast corruption in the town and revealed that New Life had made a secret arrangement with the Oak Grove Police Department to remain in business in exchange for money and sexual favors. She also accused Ed Carter of being responsible for the murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross, and believed that the department was complicit in stonewalling the investigation. The mayor became so enraged by Tammy's accusations that he ordered her to be escorted out of the building, but before she left, Tammy yelled out the name of one of the city council members, Patty Ballou. Well, it turned out that Patty Ballou had previously spent 2 years working as a sex worker at New Life, back when she was a single mother who needed to support her 2 young daughters. Patty eventually married into one of the town's leading families, got a real estate license, and became a city councilwoman, so she finally went public about her past and corroborated Tammy's claims about police corruption. The story eventually captured the attention of the mainstream media and received national coverage in such news outlets as CNN and The Washington Post, and in November of that year, Candy and Gloria's murders would be featured on an episode of Unsolved Mysteries. By this point, the Christian County Sheriff's Office had taken on the investigation, but they were unable to make much progress and decided to hand the reins over to the Kentucky State Police in 2006. Well, in July of 2012, there would be a major development in the case when the Kentucky State Police arrested the former lead detective, Leslie Duncan, and he was charged with having, quote-unquote, knowingly altered evidence which directly affected its reliability and availability for use in the investigation of the double murder. They alleged that Duncan's mishandling of the original murder scene was intentional, and he was accused of doing such things as throwing away shell casings which were found at the scene and wiping fingerprints off the phone. The following September, Duncan agreed to take a plea bargain in which he would admit that he mishandled the evidence, but still deny he had intentionally destroyed or tampered with anything, and in exchange, he received a 3-year prison sentence. However, Duncan did not know that an actual murder charge was about to be heard in front of a grand jury, and they would soon hand down an indictment. On November the 20th, 2013, Ed Carter was finally arrested and charged with the murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross, and Duncan would be charged with 2 counts of complicity to murder. But surprisingly, there was a third suspect named Frank Black, who would also be indicted on 2 counts of murder alongside Carter. Black was living in Alabama at this point, but back in 1994, he was living near Oak Grove in Clarksville, Tennessee. Unlike his 2 co-defendants, Black was never a police officer and had been working at the Opryland Hotel in Nashville during that time period. The main reason Black popped up on the radar as a potential suspect was because he had attempted to sexually assault one of the guests at the hotel at knife point only 1 night after the murders took place. Black used a long, fixed-blade knife which seemed similar to the one which had been used to slash Candy and Gloria's throats, and he wound up being convicted of attempted rape and serving 7 years in prison. One of Black's friends told investigators that Black had been a customer at New Life, so the authorities believed that Black and Carter committed the murders together, and Duncan subsequently tampered with the evidence in order to cover the whole thing up. The 3 defendants would stand trial in September of 2016, and Tammy Papler was called upon to testify. She provided a number of old cashier's checks and receipts as evidence that she had paid off Carter and other members of the police department in order to keep her operation in business. Tammy continued to believe that when she removed Carter from her payroll and barred him from the massage parlor, he murdered Candy and Gloria in retaliation. However, the prosecution faced a major uphill battle proving this because key pieces of evidence have been lost and ignored over the years, the murder weapon was never found, and no physical evidence linked Carter, Black, or Duncan to the crime. And most importantly, DNA testing revealed that the semen which had been found inside Candy's vagina and anal cavity did not match any of the 3 men. The prosecution attempted to counter this by arguing that Candy had not actually been raped by her killer, and the semen could have belonged to one of the massage parlor's customers who had consensual sex with Candy shortly before she was murdered. But the big problem with this theory was that Tammy Papler had a very strict policy that all customers had to wear condoms before engaging in sexual intercourse with her employees. And as you recall, Tammy kept detailed logbooks of all the customers who frequented her establishment, but they showed that no one had paid for sex with Candy on the night she was killed. Another issue is that the prosecution had difficulty establishing a conclusive link between Carter and Black, and they could not prove that they even knew each other, let alone committed a murder together. In spite of Duncan's previous stint in prison for mishandling the investigation, the evidence that he was fully complicit in the murders was pretty much non-existent, so his defense filed a motion asking for the judge to throw out all the charges against him and provide a directed verdict of acquittal. After the prosecution rested its case, the judge agreed to this motion and informed the jury that the charges against Duncan were no longer a factor in this trial and instructed them to find him not guilty. The jury was still free to deliberate about the charges against the two other defendants, but it took them less than 2 hours to return with a verdict. It was apparent that they did not believe the state had proven its case beyond a reasonable doubt, so Ed Carter and Frank Black were both found not guilty on all charges. The three defendants were subsequently set free, but there has not been any further investigation into the deaths of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross, and there are still no conclusive answers about who actually committed the Kentucky Bordello murders. So I guess you could say the trail went cold. So I first became familiar with this case when it was featured on Unsolved Mysteries during the late 1990s, and for the longest time, you never would have convinced me that anyone other than Ed Carter was responsible for these murders. I know that a lot of fans of the show were overjoyed when Carter was finally arrested in 2013, only to feel great disappointment when he and his alleged co-conspirators were all acquitted at trial. But once you step back and look at the actual evidence against them, it's pretty clear the jury made the right decision, and the fact that they deliberated for less than 2 hours speaks volumes. Say what you will about Ed Carter. He definitely sounds like a lousy husband, police officer, and all-around human being, but the fact that the DNA from the murder scene did not match him was a huge surprise, and really made me think that he may not be a murderer after all. I mean, there's definitely still some issues with Carter, such as a very shaky alibi during the time period the crime took place, so I can definitely understand why he seemed like a compelling suspect, but there is no actual evidence placing him at the murder scene. While I have no trouble believing that Carter's friend, Leslie Duncan, botched the investigation and mishandled evidence, it was never actually proven that he was complicit in the murders, and I think that trying him alongside Carter only complicated the prosecution's case. It's never a good sign when a judge believes that a case against a defendant is so weak that they agree to a directed verdict and instruct a jury to find them not guilty. And then there's the third defendant, Frank Black, whose name was never publicly mentioned in conjunction with this case until his arrest. While this guy was undeniably a heinous criminal who had already served time in prison, there was no evidence linking him to this crime at all, and no real motive. The prosecution didn't do a very effective job at explaining how Carter could have roped this guy into committing murder with him. I know this story wound up capturing a bunch of attention after it ballooned into a sensational scandal involving prostitution, bribery, and police corruption, but what if this had no connection at all to the murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross? Could it be possible that these two women were the victims of some opportunistic psycho, and this entire scandal is nothing more than just smoke and mirrors? Whatever the case, I have zero doubt that there was rampant corruption going on in Oak Grove, Kentucky during the 1990s, and it did not seem like the most pleasant place to live. While the Oak Grove Police Department may not have been complicit in the murders, I'm sure they accepted payoffs in order to allow New Life Fitness and Massage to stay in business, and that a number of the officers, including Ed Carter, use their services. However, I think what complicates this case is that Leslie Duncan did plead guilty and spend time in prison for tampering with evidence, though he always maintained that he did not do this intentionally or maliciously. As an example, the massage parlor's phone was off the hook before the bodies were discovered, but Duncan allegedly had the phone wiped down before it could be checked for possible fingerprints. Another crazy oversight is that Tammy Papler found the clothing Candy and Gloria had been wearing inside one of the massage parlor bathrooms the day after their bodies were discovered. But even though she called the police to stop by and collect them, they never did, even though this clothing may have contained important physical evidence. So you have to wonder if this was just incompetence, or if the Oak Grove PD was intentionally derailing the investigation and did not want the case to be solved. I think it's possible that Duncan legitimately had no idea who committed the murders when he first arrived at the scene, but he was paranoid that someone from the department might have been involved. He may have thought he was covering up for a fellow officer, such as Ed Carter, even if the crime was actually committed by someone else. But it's also possible that Duncan's actions were motivated purely by self-preservation, because he figured a murder investigation at New Life might lead to their relationship with the police department being exposed. So in essence, Duncan was trying to cover up a murder to ensure that other illegal activities would be hidden. It's worth noting that even though the authorities believed that Carter might be the killer, he was never publicly named as a suspect during the early stages of the investigation. If you look through old newspaper articles about this case from 1994, they did mention that Carter was questioned and pressured into resigning from the police force, but not because he was a potential suspect. It was because he had been doing part-time work as a janitor at New Life, and the department and the mayor was embarrassed by the idea of a police officer being employed at a house of ill repute. It was not until Tammy Papler spoke out at the city council meeting nearly 3 years later, when all the allegations about Carter trying to zone in on the business and potentially being the killer were finally made public. And of course, the sensational nature of this story ensured it would finally receive nationwide coverage from the media. It was only 4 months after Papler spoke out when Unsolved Mysteries decided to air a segment about this story, but in retrospect, it may have been a bit one-sided against Carter. I know it was common practice for people who were suspected of murder to agree to be interviewed on Unsolved Mysteries, and a lot of the time, they did not come across well and only seemed to dig themselves into a deeper hole. To Carter's credit, he actually did the wise thing by declining to be interviewed and getting his attorney to speak on his behalf, but even so, your knee-jerk reaction from the segment is that Carter was guilty of sin. But I think the issue is that it's told largely from the point of view of Tammy Papler, who might not be the most reliable narrator. Even though she was a madam, which is technically the female version of a pimp, Papler does come across as likable during her Unsolved Mysteries interview, as she paints herself as being a motherly figure to her girls, who fought diligently to seek justice for Candy and Gloria's murders, because the authorities did not believe the lives of a pair of sex workers mattered. While I do find it convenient that Tammy decided to speak out, when the city announced that they were imposing a new $5,000 license fee on her adult video store, so her actions may have been a bit more self-serving than she was letting on. In March of 2017, reporter Nick Tabor published an extensive article about this case in Oxford American Magazine, which did not paint a very flattering picture of Tammy. Some former employees claimed that she would threaten physical violence against them if they attempted to cross her, and if they stepped over the line, she would either beat them up or have them thrown in jail. When Tabor interviewed Patty Ballou, the former sex worker who joined the city council, she corroborated that she often saw Tammy threaten to kill her employees. During the murder trial for Carter, Duncan, and Black, their defense attorneys even proposed alternate scenarios which implicated Tammy herself in the murders. One scenario involved Tammy sending someone to the massage parlor to rough up Candy and Gloria in order to send a message to her employees, but the responsible parties took things too far, and both women wound up dead. Interestingly enough, the massage parlor had previously only been open until 3 a.m., but Tammy extended the hours to 5 a.m., a short time before the murders took place. And Tammy also decided to reopen for business only a few days later, even though the killer was still out there. So I guess the implication would be that if Tammy was complicit in these murders, her strategy would have been to point the finger at Ed Carter, who would seem like the most obvious suspect. However, the biggest flaw with this theory is that if Tammy was involved, there's no reason for her to speak out at the city council meeting at all. At that point, the investigation into the murders was going nowhere, so the case probably would have faded into obscurity if Tammy had kept her mouth shut. But by putting this sensational story on the record, she ensured it would receive nationwide coverage and a more extensive investigation. Hell, the story wound up capturing so much attention that Jay Leno actually made a joke about it during his monologue on The Tonight Show. Well, it seems likely that Tammy was no saint, and probably not the noble crusader for justice she painted herself out to be. This seems like a pretty irrational thing for her to do if she was guilty, and I do not see a strong motive for this crime. If she was looking to send some sort of message to her employees, I'm not sure why she would attack Candy and Gloria, as I don't get the impression that either of them had a reputation for ruffling feathers. Hell, Gloria had only been working at New Life for 2 weeks up until that point, and both women were just struggling young mothers doing anything they could do to feed their kids. And obviously, if Tammy did orchestrate the murders, there would have had to have been at least one male involved who was the source of the semen found inside Candy. It definitely would be in Tammy's best interest to push forward the narrative that the DNA was the result of consensual sex between Candy and a customer, but she has continually insisted that her clients always wore condoms. So yeah, I'm definitely not inclined to believe that Tammy was responsible for this crime, and I'm sure she genuinely believed Ed Carter was the perpetrator. However, you have to wonder if this caused investigators to develop tunnel vision and ignore other potential leads. But before I form an opinion on Carter's complicity, let's look at his whereabouts on the night of the murders. We know that even though he had been banned from the massage parlor, Carter showed up there at around 2 a.m., and I'm guessing the employees were too intimidated to kick him out. He picked up the phone and pushed a few buttons without actually making a call, but this may have just done for show, as Carter could have been using this opportunity to scope out the place and see how many people were there. Theoretically, if he was planning to commit murder, Carter's strategy would be to go outside and watch the place for a while. When Tammy Sneed, Millie Burns, and their third co-worker all left together at around 3 o'clock, Carter may have decided that this was the best opportunity since he knew that Candy and Glory were inside alone. We know that Carter initially claimed that he arrived home and climbed into bed with his wife Carol at 3 a.m., which would clear him from any involvement in the murders, if true, but Carol insisted he did not show up until after 4 a.m. It seems like Carter revised his story and said he went on to have a secret tryst with a female soldier from Fort Campbell after he left the massage parlor, which would technically count as his alibi, but I can understand the skepticism about if Carter was telling the truth. They've never publicly released any details about this soldier, but it sounds like she was never interviewed by police during the original investigation, and she likely would have been reluctant to talk anyway because she was married to someone else at the time. Carter's defense attorney apparently managed to track her down and speak with her before the trial, but believed there were enough inconsistencies with her story that it was decided not to have her take the stand and testify as a witness. In the end, her alibi did not matter much, since Carter was acquitted anyway, but you can definitely understand why he seemed like such a promising suspect for so long. I know that Carol Carter filed a domestic violence claim against her husband less than a week after the murders took place, and divorced him a short time later, so I have no doubt she genuinely thought he was responsible for this crime. I'm not saying that Carol was intentionally lying about anything in order to implicate him, but she may have interpreted certain things the wrong way. The two victims were believed to have been shot with a .22 caliber gun, and Carter supposedly kept a .22 caliber gun under his mattress, which just seemed to disappear after the crime took place. But if you watch Carol's interview on Unsolved Mysteries, she specifically says that she had not seen it since the Christmas before the shootings, which would have been 9 months earlier. So it's not like Carol had seen the gun under the mattress on September the 19th, but then it suddenly vanished after the murders took place on the 20th. The fact of the matter is that the murder weapon was never found, so it could not be conclusively proven if Carter's gun was used to commit the crime. Following his acquittal, Carter filed a federal wrongful incarceration lawsuit against the lead investigator, Kentucky State Police Officer Jason Newby, seeking compensation for the nearly 3 years he spent in jail awaiting trial. I'm not entirely sure how this lawsuit turned out, but it was alleged that Newby made a number of false statements while testifying in front of a grand jury, which helped lead to Carter's indictment for murder. For instance, Newby testified that Carol had made statements about how when her husband returned home following the murders, she saw him washing clothes. Well, the problem is that Newby never interviewed Carol at any point during this investigation, and I've never seen her mention this detail about washing clothes on Unsolved Mysteries or anywhere else. Investigators already had a fairly compelling circumstantial case against Carter, but the implication here is that they needed to spice things up a little bit to get an indictment, so Newby just flat-out fabricated some additional details. Regardless of your personal opinion about Carter's guilt or innocence, those type of actions are just very problematic and taint the entire investigation. But in spite of these issues, I would still lean towards Carter being guilty, if not for the fact that semen found in Candy's vagina and anal cavity did not match him. This could be explained away if Carter committed the crime with an accomplice, but the DNA did not match Leslie Duncan or Frank Black either. The only way this scenario works is if Candy had consensual sex with another man shortly before she was murdered. If you remember the episode I released a few years ago about the murder of Holly Staker, you'll know how enraged I get when prosecutors use this tactic in order to explain away the DNA evidence not matching the defendant. And it's known in legal circles as the quote-unquote unindicted co-ejaculator strategy. To be fair, the idea is not that absurd in this particular case, since Candy was a sex worker who was murdered at her place of employment. However, like I mentioned earlier, New Life had a very strict policy that all customers had to wear condoms before they engaged in sexual activity. In fact, when the massage parlor was shut down, the sewage tanks were discovered to be clogged with condoms because so many of them had been flushed down the toilets. But even if someone decided to ignore this rule, it was also Tammy Papler's policy to have all customers put their initials into a logbook and sign a form. But the record showed that Candy did not have sex with any customers that night. Since Tammy had strongly driven home to her employees that doing business off the books was forbidden, it seems pretty clear that the presence of semen was the result of Candy being raped. Now, since Frank Black was arrested for attempted rape the very day after this crime took place, I can see why he might look like a promising suspect, but once again, the DNA testing excluded him. I really have no idea why he was even linked to this case in the first place, since the prosecution failed to produce any evidence that he even met Ed Carter or Leslie Duncan, let alone was solicited to commit murder with them. The only real connection they had is that Black had apparently been a customer at New Life, but even that is under question, as investigators were originally told this by a friend of Black's who had a developmental disability. So there's been speculation that this guy may have been nudged to give police the answer they were looking for. I can only assume that Black's name never showed up in any of the massage parlor's logbooks, and let's not forget that Tammy Papler always insisted that each customer provide their driver's license numbers, so it's not like any of them could get away with leaving a fake name. So there's really nothing to suggest that Frank Black was involved in these murders, and I think that indicting him only added a needless complication to the state's case. When you look at all the evidence, the only way a scenario involving Ed Carter's complicity makes any sense is if he committed the murders with another accomplice besides Frank Black, who raped Candy. But that's not the scenario which was presented at trial, so there was plenty of reasonable doubt for an acquittal. Let's put it this way. If you told me back in the late 1990s that Carter would go on trial for these murders and be found not guilty after the jury deliberated for less than 2 hours, I would have said you were nuts. But once you look at the big picture, it's obvious the jury made the right decision. If Carter really was guilty, then the state made a huge error by taking him to trial on such shaky evidence, because now that he's been acquitted, he can never be charged with this crime again because of double jeopardy. So this brings up a big question. If Carter was not responsible for these murders, then who was? Well, at the trial, the defense attempted to direct suspicion towards two potential alternate suspects. The first one happened to be Gloria Ross's husband, Ryan Ross, who was a soldier at Fort Campbell at that time. The couple had been living at a trailer park and were experiencing serious financial difficulties because they were attempting to raise two kids and could not even pay their electricity and water bills. This is why Ryan pressured Gloria to get a job at a strip club before she became a sex worker at New Life, and like I mentioned earlier, Gloria had only been employed there for 2 weeks before she was killed. According to their neighbors, the Rosses were constantly arguing, and a few days before Gloria was murdered, her mother called Ryan and said that Gloria was getting ready to leave him and take their children to live with her family in Florida. It's also been rumored that Ryan attempted to hire a private investigator to follow Gloria around because he suspected she was having an affair with Candy Belt. In fact, he supposedly told the PI that if his wife turned out to be a lesbian, he might kill her. A neighbor also reported seeing Ryan leave his trailer around the approximate time period when Candy and Gloria were killed, and he always held on to Gloria's key from the massage parlor. Ryan was questioned by police during the early stages of the investigation and denied even knowing the private investigator he was alleged to have hired. While Ryan failed a polygraph test, investigators never did any follow-up with him, and he has never been asked for a DNA sample. On the surface, Ryan does seem like an intriguing alternate suspect, and if he really did believe that Gloria and Candy were having an affair, this provides a potential motive for why they were both murdered. And as far as I know, Gloria was not raped, so maybe Ryan decided to sexually assault Candy out of rage. I know that Nick Tabor managed to track down Ryan and speak to him while researching his Oxford American article in 2017, and he said that Ryan seemed genuinely surprised over the idea that he was considered a suspect and swore that he did not kill his wife. I guess one of my biggest issues is that I don't get the impression they ever tracked down this private investigator Ryan is alleged to have hired, or even confirmed this person existed, so for all we know, all these stories about Ryan getting someone to follow his wife around could be nothing more than hearsay. There are also a lot of unanswered questions, such as Ryan's alibi, and if he would have had access to the gun and the knife which were used in the murders. I mean, I don't get the impression that Ryan was a model citizen, because he and Gloria had a 6-week-old newborn at the time she was killed, and I can't imagine pushing your wife to get a job as a sex worker so soon after she's given birth. But there's one detail which I believe casts doubt on the idea of Ryan being the killer. In 1998, Ryan filed a lawsuit against Tammy and Ronnie Papler, accusing them of negligence in Gloria's death. When the Paplers failed to respond or defend themselves against the lawsuit, a federal court ruled in Ryan's favor and issued him a default judgment of $918,000, though I have my doubts the Paplers ever paid it. Well, this would have been a pretty brazen thing for Ryan to do if he committed the murders, because if the Paplers had attempted to defend themselves, Ryan may have been forced to become a witness and provide a deposition. In fact, if the Paplers' attorneys had found out that Ryan was looked at as a possible suspect and failed a polygraph, he may have been forced to answer some uncomfortable questions under oath. So without any more conclusive evidence, I can't say with any certainty whether or not Ryan Ross was responsible for this crime. The second individual, whose name has been pushed around as a potential suspect, is a man named James Stephen Henson, who worked as an appliance distributor in the nearby town of Hopkinsville in 1994. Shortly after the murders, Henson's girlfriend called the Christian County Sheriff's Office and said she believed he might be the killer. She had found receipts which showed that Henson had bought a membership at New Life, and their logbooks did have his name recorded as a customer. Henson's girlfriend said she could not account for his whereabouts between 10 p.m. on September the 19th and 9:30 p.m. on the 20th, and at one point, she saw him carrying around a bag containing a knife and gun. When she asked Henson about it, he allegedly said that he had committed 2 murders with a gun and a knife. But for whatever reason, it does not appear there was much follow-up investigation done on him. Now, what's particularly interesting is that on the night the murders took place, Tammy Sneed and Millie Burns recalled seeing a man they didn't know sitting in the massage parlor's reception area. He did not ask for any sexual services, and he just spent his time there staring off into the distance as if he was on drugs before he left. They described the man as having dark hair and a mustache, which did match the appearance of James Stephen Henson at that time. There isn't much information out there about Henson, and I have no idea what his current whereabouts are today, but regardless of whether or not the man seen in the reception area was Henson, I think this man is a very intriguing suspect. It's very odd that he would show up there in the middle of the night without requesting any services, but it's possible he was using this opportunity to scout the place. After he left, he may have kept watch over the massage parlor, and when three of the employees left at 3 a.m., and he realized that Candy and Gloria were there alone, he decided to use this opportunity to go back inside to commit rape and murder. One of the most surprising things about this crime is that it occurred in a window of only around 35 minutes or so, as the killer was already gone by the time Sneed and Burns returned. The odds of some random psycho just stopping by at that time of night during a very narrow time frame are pretty remote. So I have to believe that he was watching the place and took advantage of a time frame when there were only two women there to handle. In the end, the killer's motive may not have had anything to do with police corruption or the scandal involving New Life. He may have simply wanted to kill someone that night, and Candy and Gloria were just in the wrong place at the wrong time. The perpetrator could have been James Stephen Henson, or maybe it was some unknown predator who has never appeared on the radar as a suspect. That's the thing with the massage parlor being in such close proximity to Fort Campbell, as around 24,000 soldiers were stationed there at that time, along with their dependents and around 4,000 civilian employees, and a number of these people were customers at New Life. If the killer was a soldier, for all we know, he could have been transferred to another location a short time later. It was completely overlooked when the investigation took place. Whoever this perpetrator was, they may have gotten incredibly lucky that there was a corrupt police officer working in that town who became the perfect diversion. To me, one of the biggest tragedies of this whole story is that with all this drama involving small-town politics, prostitution, and police corruption, the two actual victims, Candy and Gloria, are often lost in the shuffle. Most of the sources provide a bare minimum of information about their backgrounds, only that they were both struggling young women who took jobs they were probably not particularly thrilled with because they had to support their children, who wound up being left without their mothers. And the sad thing is that when you look at the economic situation in Oak Grove, these women really didn't have many options, as it seems like the main sources of employment there were working at Fort Campbell or becoming involved in adult entertainment. Even Patty Ballou, who eventually joined the city council, was forced to turn to sex work after she moved to Oak Grove and was dumped by a soldier she was involved with, as she needed to support her children through any means necessary. Say what you will about Tammy Papler, but even though she exploited a lot of these young women, she did make a valid point when she said that the authorities showed no interest in solving these murders because the victims were sex workers whom they barely considered to be human beings. There were likely a lot of people in power who hoped the case would just go away, and while you can question Tammy's motives for speaking out and thrusting this story into the national spotlight, it's possible that Candy and Gloria's deaths would have been completely forgotten if she hadn't done this. But unfortunately, even though an arrest was eventually made in this case, it did not lead to a resolution. It seems like the authorities, and the community in general, continue to hold the attitude that Carter, Black, and Duncan were still guilty of this crime, and since none of these men can ever be charged again, there's nowhere else to go. But I do believe this case merits further investigation, particularly since we have alternate suspects, such as Ryan Ross and James Stephen Henson, who have never had their DNA taken and tested against the evidence. Hell, we've seen genetic genealogy lead to arrests in so many cold cases these past 3 years, so why not enter the perpetrator's DNA into a genealogy database and see where it leads? But unfortunately, if they did this, the authorities would have to admit they made a mistake and got the wrong people the first time around, and it seems like they're not willing to do this. I mean, I would be the first person to admit that I thought Ed Carter was the guilty party for a long time, but I'm also willing to change my opinion if the evidence points in another direction, and all I want to see is justice for these two murdered women. So if you happen to have any information about the murders of Candy Belt and Gloria Ross, please contact the appropriate authorities. Anyway, another special thanks to Samantha Hope Cannon for narrating the intro of our episode. If you've already entered our listener voiceover contest before, you are automatically eligible for our next random drawing, so you don't have to do anything. But if you would like to enter and haven't done so yet, all you have to do is send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, naming the one unsolved cold case you would most like to see covered on this podcast. So once again, send me an email under the subject line, Trail Went Cold Contest, to robin.warder@icloud.com. That's robin.warder@icloud.com. I'd also like to give a shout-out to the podcast Southern Fried True Crime, hosted by Erica Kelly, as one of her show's earliest episodes was a two-part series about this case. It went into a lot more detail about the history and background of Oak Grove, Kentucky, so I highly recommend you check it out. Now, the reminder that The Trail Went Cold is on Patreon, so please visit patreon.com/thetrailwentcold to learn how you can support our podcast and become eligible for some pretty neat rewards. We produced a bunch of exclusive bonus episodes for our patrons in tiers 2 and 3, and this past month, I released an episode on a famous case from Unsolved Mysteries about wanted fugitive Adam Emery, who may have faked his death after he was convicted of murder and has not been seen for nearly 30 years. And for our patrons in Tier 3, I've also recorded another new audio commentary track, which can be played over a classic episode of Unsolved Mysteries. I'd also like to give a shout out to our most recent listeners who have signed up with us on Patreon this week, and they are Susan A., Valerion, Jen T., Mecca M., and Nuria S. Thank you all so much for your support. I'd also like to mention that later this year, provided that it becomes safe to travel again, The Trail Went Cold is going to be appearing on Podcast Row at the very first CrimeCon UK, which is being held at the Leonardo Royal Hotel and Spa in London on the weekend of September the 25th and 26th. If you would like to purchase tickets to the event, we have a special promo code you can use to get a 10% discount. So to receive 10% off, visit crimecon.co.uk and enter the promo code COLD21. That's COLD21. In addition, I wanted to provide another reminder that I hold live streaming sessions on a platform called Get Vocal. Every Thursday night from 7 until 8 p.m. Eastern Time, I host what is essentially an after show for each week's podcast episode, where I have an interactive discussion about the featured case from said episode and answer questions and address comments from listeners. I always include a link to these sessions in our show notes, so be sure to check there for more information or visit getvocal.com. That's getvocal.com. I just wanted to give another shout-out to my supporters at the Unsolved Mysteries message board at the Sitcoms Online forum and the Unresolved Mysteries subreddit. I need to provide a big thanks to Miguel Foote, who edits and assembles this podcast together for me, and Vince Nitro, who composes the eerie music you hear on every episode. If you haven't already, you can like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter, or leave us a rating or review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Podcasts, or Spotify. So have yourself a good week and join us next Wednesday for another brand new episode of The Trail Went Cold. We'll be right back.